Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are listening to this recording. Welcome to the second episode of the In Diverse Company podcast series. And today's episode is going to be focused on showcasing an organization that has successfully created inclusive culture. It's with great pleasure to introduce you all to our speaker for today's podcast episode. Her name is Janet Tidmarsh. She is currently the head of diversity and inclusion at Whitbread PLC. And I'm going to pass over to Janet to just say a few words about herself.
Thank you so much, Lloyd. It's such a pleasure to be part of your podcast today. So, yes, I work at Whitbread, which many of you might not have heard of Whitbread, but I'm sure you've heard of our brands, Premier Inn, Beef Eater, Brewers Fair, and probably stayed with us or dined with us at some point. We're based across the UK, Germany, and other territories as well. Just delighted to be here. I've been head of diversity and inclusion for 2.5 years, but had the passion for this as a topic for much longer. So delighted to talk about it.
You began your career working in sales.
I did.
Before transitioning into a head of talent and inclusion role in 2009. And I find that really interesting that, you know, you can go from a sales environment into a talent and inclusion environment. And so I just wondered, you know, what was it that attracted you to making that switch and working in the talent and inclusion area?
So my early career was very much spent, I was somebody who left school and didn't really know what I wanted to do as a career. I wasn't really sure what my passion was, but I knew that I liked people and I knew that I liked being around people. So as many people do in their late teens, early 20s, I did a lot of customer service facing work. So hotels, restaurants, retail, and really enjoyed that side of work, worked in a lot of customer industries, and found myself working for Virgin, who just have a fantastic culture that's very people orientated. And like you say, I was working for Virgin in a sales based role. So, you know, the person on the street corner who's trying to sell you to come and join a health club, that was me. But actually what I realised was that whilst sales was interesting, what I found more interesting was how you support people to be their best, which actually through being a manager, supporting your team, doing all of those things was really interesting. And an opportunity came to move to a people function to train salespeople. So the steps between sales and talent and inclusion, there were probably a couple of steps in there, but the first one was training and supporting salespeople to be their best. That then morphed into how do you support people with their broader careers. That then took me from the UK to living in South Africa for a period of time, which was my first introduction into inclusion, which, although it wasn't called inclusion in 2009, it was all about inclusion in an environment that South Africa has a lot of cultural challenges, or it did in 2009. Very different place to live, very different place to manage talent and your career. Your race was very much on display to people in a way that I hadn't experienced in the UK. And it wasn't always the most inclusive place to be, but there was a lot of privilege. And my role was supporting people who had less privilege. So actually, a lot of the time I was supporting people to learn to read and write for the first time, or people who came from the background of living in a township. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of things that today we would consider to be inclusion initiatives, but they weren't badged up as that in 2009 in South Africa. But that was my first exploration into the topic, and I absolutely loved it. And that was where I decided that was the part of the world, both literally and figuratively, that I wanted to spend my career.
And I find that really fascinating that you were already doing work within the inclusion space even before inclusion was a name that, you know, people were associating with in terms of, you know, a career path that, you know, people could take. So I find that fascinating that 14 years on, you've probably seen a lot happen and you've seen developments in the field and how that's evolved over time.
Absolutely. And also the difference between different cultures as well. And a real, I guess what my trip to South Africa gave me was a really strong understanding that inclusion is very cultural. And if you ignore that, you're not going to do it in the right way. And that's certainly come into use in the current business where we talk about the differences between the UK and Germany and what some of that means. But that kind of was embedded in me very many years ago.
And so I guess kind of fast forward into recent times, it's really amazing to see the amount of external recognition that Whitbread has been getting recently. And just to read out a few of them. So a Gold Award for Excellence and First in Sector in the 2022 Stonewall Workplace Equality Index, ranked 24th in the FT Diversity Leaders Index, Top FTSE Women Leaders Index for Executive Direct Reports for female representation. And so I guess sort of just pausing, as I'm sure you've already done, and, you know, reflecting on these different awards and recognition that you've achieved, what do you consider as the main factors that have contributed to achieving this recognition?
I think it's a really good question. And actually, you asking that question really made me sit and reflect on what do I think? Because I didn't join this business with a long heritage of these this recognition. You know, like lots of businesses, Whitbread has really had to think carefully about what inclusion means as part of its culture and what part diversity plays in that. And particularly, I would say, as many companies did in 2020, following the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement gaining such momentum, I think there was a moment for lots of businesses to go, are we taking this topic seriously enough? And how can we move forward and accelerate our progress more? And that started, I would say, a new tranche of work, a new phase in our work over that period of time that started with the creation of some commitments. So I led the creation of 8 commitments. And I think what has really helped us is to say, yes, diversity is important to us, and we are absolutely committed to certain areas around diversity, but an underpinning belief that it all starts with inclusion, and we have to get an inclusive culture to drive diversity. You can't just go after the diversity, that makes logical sense. But I think maybe many businesses do go, right, we need to achieve these diversity targets, as opposed to if we start with the culture, if we believe in the culture we want to create, if we make sure that we're saying and doing the right things for our communities, the diversity will follow. It'll be a bit longer. It's a longer journey to get there, but it's a more sustainable journey and it's more authentic as well.
And I picked up there on a comment you made about, you know, saying and doing the right things. And it sounds to me that as an organization, you went through a process of identifying some deliberate actions that you wanted to take and to implement off the back of, you know, the tragic incident of George Floyd's passing. Are there any other factors that you feel have contributed in some way? Or would you say that these are the main things?
So I think there's everything that I described. I would say the other key component is the sponsorship, the advocacy and the buy-in of the CEO and the executive committee. Everything that I've asked for in the last 2.5 years, I've got. I've had investment into training, into system developments, at a point where the business was announcing £1 billion loss. There was still an investment and an understanding that this was important and it couldn't wait. And I think some of those things signified to the community how important it was, but also meant that we accelerated our progress quicker. But I don't think you can underestimate the level of senior not even just sponsorship. There was a real drive and an energy and again, a real authenticity to that that makes me really want to do this well in this business.
Brilliant. Thank you. And so kind of moving on to my next question then. So at Whitbread, diversity and inclusion is embedded within the ESG approach. And for those listeners who don't know what ESG is, that is the environmental, social and governance approach. And so what I wanted to hear from you about is what was the rationale for embedding diversity and inclusion within ESG? And what do you think are the benefits of adopting this approach?
So I'll start with saying that the embedding of D&I within the ESG approach predated my time with Whitbread. So it's not something I can personally take any credit for.
That's fine.
What I would say is that there's a real collaboration between it being embedded within our ESG program, which we call Force for Good, and also as part of that within our people strategy as well. So a lot of diversity and inclusion teams sit within people functions from an organisational structure perspective, as do I. So actually, we do sit within the people structure, but there's a real richness to this topic that's missed if you only focus on your people. And I think that's where the ESG framework helps us. So, yes, we think about the people that work for us. We think about the communities that we serve in terms of employment. But also within that social part of ESG, it's about supporting people to live better lives, whether they're people who work for us, whether they are customers, or whether they're local communities that just sit in and around our Premier Inns and restaurants, and independently whether or not they choose to dine with us or work for us, actually we should be still supporting them to live better lives. And I think that unlocks something in terms of our responsibility that we have as a large employer and a large FTSE 100 business within the country as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess, you know, looking at it also from a macro perspective, you know, you have all of this discourse that is happening within society about, you know, different issues. And obviously for organisations like Whitbread, they can play a part in their own way to help address some of the social issues and to have an impact on society, I would say. And so I think it's interesting, certainly hearing some of the kind of thinking behind how that all came about and the different things that you can unlock with regards to being associated with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the teams that work for us want to see that as well. So it all is quite cyclical in terms of, you know, that we want to attract diverse talent from minority communities to come and work for us. To do that in an authentic way, we not only have to provide them with an inclusive culture so they want to stay, but we have to think about how we treat guests who come from an all groups of diverse communities that we know we serve across our restaurants and hotels, but also think about the communities more broadly that we serve as well. So I think it all works together in terms of our different our different groups that we serve in different ways.
And you mentioned earlier on about the commitments that you made. So this was kind of sort of, you know, a few years back now. And I just wanted you to, if you don't mind, to just expand on some of those commitments that you were referring to. And also, since they came into being, how have those commitments evolved to, you know, the present day?
So we brought in the commitments in 2020. I think lots of businesses were thinking about commitments that summer of 2020. And I was very clear to go, we have commitments around diversity and we have commitments around inclusion. So if I touch on our diversity commitments first, we have four commitments that are broadly around how are we going to increase representation of minority communities, particularly in more senior roles across Whitbread. Like lots of businesses, we're not as representative in some ways as we would like to be, but it's all about how we get there through a combination of how we buy or resource talent externally and how we grow our own talent for the future, along with there's a real important data piece in here around an understanding of how people identify, and therefore we can understand more about future targets, for example, as a result of that. So there's a combination of four targets that sit there that are around senior level representation in terms of gender and ethnicity. There is a target around thinking about recruitment and how you recruit, and thinking about bias and things like that during the recruitment process. There's a target around how we support and develop diverse talent for the future. So supercharging diverse talent, I think, is what the wording says. And then the fourth is around data and getting more data. And we've gone on quite a journey with data, particularly around sexual orientation, gender identity and disability, where we've had to rebuild our system to be able to accept some of that data. And we're now on a period of encouraging our teams to disclose their optional personal data to us, so then we can set future targets and understand more, etc. So I think the piece around data and diversity is one section. And then the other section is around inclusion. So like I've touched on already, there are then separate actions and separate commitments that focus on inclusion. So these are around having thriving networks that are communities that drive change, but also provide social support for people from different communities along with allies. This is around our policies. So these are policies for teams, but also policies for guests to go, what are we saying we do? So we've had to create new policies. We've had to review policies, things like gender identity, menopause, supporting our teams through Ramadan, lots of different topics that we've heard are important to our teams. So that has been a really important stream of work. The third is around education. I do believe if there's one thing that you do around the whole topic around D&I, education is the most important thing you can do. So that's everybody. That's your leaders. That's your frontline teams. That's how you interact with others. That's guests, everything. And then the fourth one is around the celebration of events. And the reason I mentioned that one last, partly it's because the bit that everyone finds quite easy to do, and lots of organisations will do that, it's also the part that can be really good or really superficial. So, for example, you could say Happy Diwali and you could send a message out to everybody. If that community doesn't feel included, if that community doesn't feel that they have, you have the right policies around it for them to be able to celebrate Diwali, or if there's no education to allies around an understanding of why it's important, it's really superficial and it doesn't land well, in my view. But if you combine them all together, it can be really powerful. I'll give you another example, if it's okay, Lloyd. Where what you say and what you do are really important, and it's really easy to be misaligned on them. So we started down this road of going, we're going to celebrate lots of things. And in our first year, we created a calendar, like lots of businesses do, and started celebrating these different events. And it was Rosh Hashanah, 1 September. And we'd done a piece around celebrating and education and understanding with our Jewish community to help everybody understand why it was important. And that was great. Then somebody from our Jewish community said to us, Janet, just so you know, it's brilliant that we're doing all of this, but there was a really important meeting that I had to go to that was scheduled on Rosh Hashanah. And that kind of detracted from my experience of being able to celebrate with my family. And it really struck me that actually that's a, you know, these meeting schedules are set a year in advance. And we have to pick up to go, these are key dates. We wouldn't put one of these meetings on Christmas Day. But so why does it happen on this day? What we're saying and what we're doing are in danger of doing two different things here. So we could then pick that up as an action, and my team could go, right, we just need to feed in at the right point in the year to make sure these dates are no-go dates, just like you would for Christmas or Easter, for example, which are obviously bank holidays. So it's slightly different, but it's not different to the community. So I think it's a good example of where inclusion, sometimes you can trip yourself up a little bit if you're not careful.
Yeah, it's going beyond simply saying that you're embracing other cultures. Because you can say you're embracing other cultures, but actually if you're not taking the time to be thoughtful or considerate to those other people, then in the end, you end up pushing your own culture onto someone else's when actually that's not really appropriate to do. So I do like that example. Thank you very much for sharing that. As you mentioned, right at the beginning, you've been in your role for, I think, 2.5 years now or something like that. And I just wondered, looking back, you know, what would you consider as like the main achievements within your role so far?
I think you might have mentioned most of them already, Lloyd. And we actually, there was one that you didn't mention that I am going to mention. So last month we got showcased in the Stonewall 2023 Workplace Results. Oh, wow. So we got a gold award again and first in sector again. And we got into the top 100 employers at number 53 this year as well. So I would say that was the biggest achievement so far. Because mm-hmm. actually to get to number 53 in that most rigorous of workplace indices is it is quite an achievement, and you can't get there through luck. You get there through hard, rigorous work with your communities that they tell you whether or not you're getting it right. I think it's the reason this topic can be so complex is because quite often it's the amalgamation of lots of small things that you do across the course of the year that provide the sum total of meaningfulness to somebody. It's the policy, it's the network, it's the event, it's the fact they can see the role model in the leadership, it's the fact it was talked about in a huddle. There's a number of small things over many, many months that will be important to somebody that signal that this is a safe environment for me and this is a place I feel I can be myself. Mm. So I think some of those things that kind of culminate in the external showcase of it are really, really important. The other thing I would say that I'm really proud of is our employee networks. Because mm-hmm. for anybody out there on the podcast that's tried to set up an employee network, wow, it takes some time and effort and energy to actually set it up in the first place. So we had one already when I joined Whitbread, and we set another 3 up over a course of a 12-month period. And that was through a lot of hard work, going out and talking to people, finding people with passion for making a change and making a difference and coming to get involved, you know, on top of their busy day job, to come and get involved in this because they're passionate about it. I think that's the part I'm probably proudest of, alongside some of the external recognition, because we've just got some fantastic people who really care.
Indeed, it's like the it's cliched, but you know, it's so true that, you know, you need, you know, a village of people to really make a difference. You know, one person alone can't do it all on their own. So it sounds like, you know, you've got a really good, strong team of individuals within the organization who are all kind of helping to make things bigger together than if they were kind of, you know, separate parts, so to speak. Great. Thank you so much. So I guess kind of moving on now to the next question. You kind of touched upon it earlier at the beginning. So you mentioned about how you have a presence in Germany. So this is one of the other countries. And so I kind of wondered, really, when you look at the UK and you look at Germany as two examples, what do you think are the sort of commonalities and differences with regards to diversity inclusion strategies and initiatives? How have you sort of experienced it so far?
So I think there is a surprising amount of difference between two countries that are relatively geographically close together. And there's an easy assumption that Europe generally feels in one way about lots of things. And actually, things in Germany are very different to in the UK. I guess what underpins it all is a similar belief that inclusion is important and that everybody should be able to feel like they can belong when they're in the workplace. Everybody should be able to feel like they can be themselves. But there are different laws in Germany. You know, there are some questions, like I touched on around data, some of those questions we can't ask our colleagues in Germany. The conversation around race is very different, is very clear, partly because the word race itself has very clear connotations to World War II. Therefore, our race and ethnicity targets are very UK specific. But in Germany, what is possible and what is valued is to talk about nationality. So there are different conversations happening. Gender is something that's interesting, and I think female representation is probably the one area that is fairly consistent across the two territories. But I think, as with everything, this is about understanding the local culture and understanding what fits, understanding what the local society understands, because actually otherwise you're doing something that's really not appreciated and is quite ignorant in some ways, to go, well, we do this in the UK, let's just do it in Germany as well. So we've gone through a period of consultation. We have slightly different targets in Germany, but overall our commitments to inclusion are the same. Because actually, you know, when we talk about networks, when we talk about policies, actually the intent is the same. How you get there and what you actually say would be different. And our networks are set up separately, but they do have connections in as well. I think the probably one area that is very similar is supporting the disabled customer experience would be one area that is very similar, where the teams can work together, you know, particularly supporting people with physical mobility issues and having things like, you know, accessible bedrooms in a Premier Inn, for example, is an area that the networks can work on together.
Great. Thank you. I guess my next question really is just sort of thinking about best practice approaches for implementing DEI strategies within global organizations. We've obviously touched already on the subject of, you know, cultural differences in the UK and Germany. And I just wondered, what were your kind of thoughts and perspectives about how you find that balance between having a regional or a global framework within a large corporate organization, but at the same time still sort of maintaining that kind of local idiosyncrasies, local interpretations, if you like, of the global or regional frameworks? How does that work? What do you think best practice looks like?
For me, I think there's something really global about this, in terms of you need one aim overall, and that aim might be as simple as we want to be as inclusive everywhere in the world. But actually, the more important part is the local part here. And, you know, local networks, local strategies. You know, if you even look at different territories and you took the topic of race and ethnicity, actually, it has to be local. It has to be based around the geography that you're based in, or it becomes a bit diluted and meaningless if you're trying to all work together. Or at worst, you end up doing the wrong things for a community within a different geography. And I think the worst thing you can do within this space is not listen or try and push something that isn't right, because the communities are often underrepresented already, and actually they're struggling maybe to be themselves at work. So therefore, trying to support them in the right way is really important. I think whilst having a global purpose, a global intent around the right way that sits as part of a business's culture is important, but actually the local part for me would be the far more imperative part to make sure it works. Sure.
That kind of brings me on to my next question. I was really amazed. I had a prior knowledge of Whitbread, as I mentioned before. But actually, when I was doing my kind of research, just sort of realizing how many brands there are within Whitbread was quite amazing. And you know, examples including Premier Inn, Beefeater, Fine Bar and Grill, Brewers Fair. I'm sure there are more that I've not mentioned. I wondered, because it kind of makes it quite interesting and quite unique, because Whitbread obviously is a big organization with several brands, which I'm assuming all have different cultures as well, within those brands, different ways of working. And so I kind of wondered, really, how do you develop a DEI strategy whilst sort of taking into consideration the fact that you've got all these different, you know, brands within the organization? What are the sort of idiosyncrasies that maybe you need to kind of respect in order to ensure that it's working for everyone?
It's interesting because within our team, so whilst we have lots of different brands and everyone will be very familiar with the Premier Inn brand, we have this really interesting business model where the restaurants are co-located very often to the hotel. So if you're a hotel guest, you'll go into the restaurant and you'll have your dinner or your breakfast there. And that restaurant might be in the hotel, in which case it'll be called a Time restaurant, or it'll be across the car park. So it might be a Brewer's Fair or a Beef Eater or a Bar and Block or something like that. And therefore, although each brand can have its own identity, and from a guest or customer perspective, it often does, from a team perspective, we try as much as possible to keep it close together, because actually the experience of the guest has to flow across the car park and back again, literally. So it's not necessarily as hard as you would think, whereas I guess in perhaps other businesses where they have very disparate brands with very different brand propositions and maybe teams that aren't so co-located, close physically, and also quite often brought together. What also helps is that they all do sit under one management structure as well within our organisation. Right. So they're all sat under one leadership function, if you like. So although there are idiosyncrasies, they're probably less than them perhaps are in other organisations that have a family of brands.
Great. No, thank you for clarifying that. So I want to move on to something else that I noticed, which I found really, really great. And I think it's something that definitely should be applauded. On your website, you have some new policies and guides which you launched, including a guide to fasting at Ramadan, a workplace guide to menopause, a gender identity and transitioning policy as well. That's not something that I have come across at a lot of different organizations. And so what I really wanted to understand is how these new policies have been implemented, but also what key learnings have you derived so far that you would be happy to share with our listeners?
Sure. So these policies were specifically chosen partly based on, I would say, best practice. So, for example, having a gender identity and transitioning policy is showcased within the Stonewall Index as best practice. So, of course, we would adopt that. Other things such as the guide to fasting at Ramadan. Actually, we heard from our teams that this was a really important area. So we wanted to provide additional support around how they could support and help their teams. So there are different reasons for being almost around some of the different things that we've done, but very much in consultation with our teams as to, you know, we want to spend our time and our energy doing things that are important to our organisation and to our team. So very much done in conjunction with our listening team. What I would say is that these have been implemented through our networks, and these are a key important part of where our networks have played an active role. Sometimes I see inclusion networks that are about the social community and people coming together and having a safe space. That is all very, very important, and our networks definitely play that role. They also have a lot of influence, and they come and get actively involved in driving change, and that includes looking for opportunities to make our policies better, opportunities to input into it, talk to the communities and go, right, okay, so we think menopause is a really key area, therefore we need a guide. And the reason we think it's quite a key area, it's a good example, is that we've taken a really data-led approach with this. We can see that 67% of our workforce are female, and you know, you can see that in our gender pay gap report. We absolutely believe that menopause is a key area for our workforce, and therefore, of course, we would look at a guide, and of course, we would try and understand what that means. And we're also signed up to become a menopause-friendly employer, and we're hoping to get that accreditation over the next 12 months or so. So these are, again, all key steps of what are important to our teams. In terms of learnings, I think as with any business that has a lot of its workforce that are not in front of computers all the time, the hard part is getting your policy in front of your person that needs it. So, you know, if you think about your housekeeper, you know, they will come in, they will clean their rooms and they will go home. So how do we get the things that matter to them in front of them at the right time? And that comes through, obviously, our internal communications plans and making sure we work really closely in collaboration with them. With our menopause guide, we also listened to some feedback and we've translated that into 5 additional languages for our teams as well, knowing that English isn't the first language for many of our teams. And again, we can see on our HR system what the most popular or first languages are. So we knew which languages to translate it into to make sure it was adding value to the right people at the right time. As with any policy, it's about not just writing the policy. You know, a lot of work goes into wordsmithing the policy, but the intent of the policy and making sure that it gets to the right person. So if you take a gender identity policy, because you mentioned it, if an individual is looking for that policy and wanting to transition, they're probably not going to want to go and ask their line manager for that policy. So how do we make sure that that policy gets into the right hands at the right time? And we've had to do a few workarounds in terms of our internal systems to make sure that that's entirely possible, particularly with the makeup of our workforce and how many of our workforce, you know, aren't sat in an office in front of a laptop every day.
I wondered what the sort of main focus areas are for Whitbread in 2023 with regards to diversity and inclusion. You've obviously talked about a few things already. You've talked about some of the initiatives that you're working on, going for a menopause-friendly accredited company as one example. But I guess looking at it from a holistic, you know, perspective, so both the macro and the micro, is there anything that you'd want to share with us or happy to share with us that you're doing?
So I think the first thing I would say is that our commitments stay as they are. And there's something quite secure around the stability of keeping some things the same. So our commitments have changed very little since we brought in around them in 2020, and they will stay the same again this year. So the first thing we do is have a really disciplined approach to everything that we want to do has to be based around the commitments, or we're not doing it. So for this year, that will continue. There's a lot of activity, like you said, around calendar events, around celebrating certain things as we go through the year. In terms of our change agenda, so what are we looking to transform this year? We really want to do more spend time this year really thinking about disability confident. So we are disability confident level 1 at the moment, and it's definitely we are level 1 with the aspiration to move forwards over the next few years towards level 3. So we're currently working on our plans for how do we get to level 2, and looking at some of the things that we need to do around that, so we can make sure that we're supporting people with disabilities into the workplace as much as we possibly can, because that's an area as a business we're really passionate about. We know that only 5% of people with disabilities are in paid employment in the UK, and we see that as a real opportunity working in a sector where there are no barriers to entry. So we should be able to move forward with our aspirations around that this year. That would be my call out area. In terms of other areas, I think we've got more work to do around how we continue to develop talent. I think, like lots of organisations, I think I've said it already, we would like to be more diverse at a senior level in lots of different ways. So how do we do that through the growth and career opportunities of people who are working for us today? And in some ways, I think for many organisations, including ours, that's a bit of a never-ending journey. But one we continue with and one we want to put some focus on, continued focus on this year.
And so I guess to my kind of last question before we wrap up, what are your thoughts about the direction in which equality, diversity and inclusion is heading in general? And how do you perceive the EDI field developing over time? It's a big question, I know, crystal ball sort of moment, but if there's anything you thought about that you want to share.
So I think if we look back, the progress of how important this topic is within society has made a pleasing amount of progress in the last 3 years. You can very whatever your media choice, there is now so much choice both to educate yourself further, or the fact that it is getting called out where people are not having great experiences, and actually in a different way from a few years ago, that this is now societally important to us, that places are inclusive, whether that's sport, whether that's through media, or whether that's the responsibility of big businesses such as us. So I think a lot of the conversations that I saw happening 6 or 7 years ago around the business case for D&I, you know, pulling out the McKinsey research that says diverse companies are more profitable, we've moved past that, which is so pleasing. We're starting in a different place. And I find that really energizing. My hope for the future would be that as we move forward generationally, and we can see that younger generations identify in a broader different number of ways. You know, we've seen that through some of the research organisations like Stonewall have done, that actually there'll be a point in time where a function and a job like the one I'm doing today is not needed. Because actually there is a greater level of understanding. You know, all of those things around education that I spoke about, it would be my hope that certainly, you know, my daughter's 7, so that her generation would not need this type of function within a business, because actually everything is so embedded that it's just the normal of how things happen.
Or it might just be a case that it's called something else and, you know, the work still carries on. So almost going back full circle to where you started in your career journey. Great. Well, thank you so much, Janet, for your time today. I know how busy you are with your various work commitments. So a genuine thank you for taking this time out to chat with me.